Well, my name is David Lynch, not the movie director, although we are here at in Hollywood, California.
That did actually cross my mind.
And I get that asked a lot. I certainly wish I had a nickel for every time someone's asked a question about that. My current occupation and position is I'm an assistant chief of a third service county ambulance service, Johnson County MedAct in Johnson County, Kansas. I started my career in EMS in 1977 after graduating from college back in Adrian, Michigan, with a focus on Methodist ministry, which kind of changed when I changed faiths, but came to Kansas City to work on a master's in music and married the wife that I have now and started in EMS as an EMT. And worked my way through paramedic school in both the states of Missouri and Kansas. Worked as a paramedic on the streets for a short time, and then took a position in Independence, Missouri, in a paramedic program, and started a paramedic program and ran it for 5 years, and then came back to MedAct in the chief role for education and training. That has taken me over the face of roughly 28 years now. In a career that has allowed me to express my passion and to help realize the professional aspects of what emergency medical services are all about, of which I am still extremely passionate. In the course of my education and training in EMS, I've been allowed to participate in several national focuses, one of which is the Committee on Accreditation for paramedic programs, as we know it, COAMPS, COAMSP, and as a chair for that organization some years ago, and then as a board member for roughly 18 years. Opportunities to get out and see many paramedic programs as a site visitor and to be a reviewer for a number of programs in the same vein. As I take information back to my own service, and as I have the opportunity to develop instructors and to develop employees in our particular service, the thing that really strikes me about EMS is that we are not yet a profession. But we can certainly be professional at what we do. And I've seen our organization wax and wane from the effective domain of being very passionate and very professional about their activities, and in the course of time have also seen the lulls of people who have lost that passion and what toll that takes on delivering good EMS to patients and those that we serve. We're lifelong learners, and as we can remember when we've graduated or completed either EMT school or paramedic school, we're challenged to continually learn. Our ability to challenge ourselves individually is something that we're obligated to do. We need to be on top of the game. We can't rely on someone always to be able to facilitate that for us in professional training. We have to be willing to seek that out. And if we don't, we fall behind. It's easy to get burned out. It's easy to get rusted out if we're too busy or not busy enough. But in the obligation that we have to challenge ourselves to learn, I was always told coming up through school in EMS that medicine is not an exact science. To quote a mentor of mine, Ray Wright, who is still a paramedic program coordinator for Johnson County Community College, that has stuck with me for a long time. And as we think about medicine, for those who have been involved in it for greater than 10 years, it's been pretty cyclical. We'll identify some modality that works and goes out of vogue, and here it is back again, and we're using it to treat another patient for some other malady. So we are constantly being challenged to change. And if change isn't something we're comfortable with, then we're not going to survive well in this career, or what we want to call a profession. What keeps us from being a profession? I really believe that what keeps us from being a profession is the minimal mentality that we in EMS like to hang on to. We're always burdened by the lowest common denominator. What does it take to get by? Do you have a pulse and a patch? Are employers willing to hire the cream of the crop versus the best, versus not the best person, but someone just to staff their units? Do we always have to look at the rural environment, who always feels disenfranchised when we raise standards or increase requirements? And I have lots of angst about the states that have to struggle with that in appreciating what needs to be the common denominator for minimalism and being expert at what we do. We constantly fight that. We're on the road right now to identify through the Education Agenda for the Future, looking at opportunities to bring us in line with what a profession is in the emergency medical services, from being an emergency medical responder to a paramedic. The attitude and behaviors don't change. We have an obligation to strive to be the best we can be, to steal a military term, which applies to all of us in service, to be the best we possibly can be, better tomorrow than we were today. And we have to plan for that. We can't rely on our instructors to prepare it for us. We have to challenge ourselves. And I think that's the greatest challenge we have as educators and as practitioners in EMS.
What do you think is going to be the biggest driving force to push EMS into a profession?
Well, again, I think it's really a personal attitude. I think it's, as an employer, I have to be willing to say, you know, I'm only going to hire people from an accredited paramedic program. I'm only going to allow interns to intern with our service if they've come from an accredited paramedic program. I want to push my state to utilize a national certification exam to identify raising the credentials. I want to push all states to consider and to believe in the fact that the national scope of practice model is where we all need to go consistently. So we've got qualified, valid, and reliable educational standards. We have qualified, valid, and reliable national accreditation, and the same for certification. And until we really identify that, then those with whom we serve in nursing and medicine and medical technology aren't going to look at us as equals. We're not an academic focused profession. How many mom and pop programs still exist that don't provide the resources to students that can be provided in a post-secondary institution that does that? Now, that may sound pretty altruistic from the perspective of thinking that can happen across the country, but you know, if you're a doctor and you graduate from med school at the lowest of your class, you're still a doctor.
Right.
And the standards for which there are for medicine for physicians and nurses don't change because you live in a rural environment.
Right.
Why should that be any different in emergency medical services?
Yeah. And that brings up another question about the, you know, where do you stand? I guess you can, you know, it seems fairly obvious, but where do you stand on the degree versus certificate question?
Well, obviously that's a fairly hot issue today. I think it's clear that as professional people, getting a well-rounded education is important. I think there's still a battle to appreciate when you start at the first responder or the emergency medical responder level and move towards paramedic, that it's as graduated as it could be as you are going through nursing school. Mm-hmm. But attaining a degree says that you have gone the race. You have persevered to the level that one would expect you to go in an academic approach for EMS. So I do not feel that it's inappropriate to identify a degree program, especially to be a paramedic, at no less than an associate's degree, and preferably a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. Educators need to identify their lot in life as moving well beyond the bachelor's degree and identifying master's level education for the perspective of training trainers. Now, that's difficult at an EMT level and maybe shouldn't be the same requirement. But we need to tie academics to the vo-technical type training, which when you look at EMS training today, can still easily be equated to as vo-tech. Mm-hmm. And I would like to think that we're well beyond vo-tech. When the life of a patient is in your hands, even for the brief period of time that you have them, and you are performing skills that equal that of physicians and critical care nurses, it would certainly be an expectation that you have accomplished those levels of higher learning. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean that we can't do the job without attaining that level of education? Of course not. And we've seen where that's come. But if we want to attain the same respect and the same understanding of our brothers and sisters in the allied health profession, then we're going to have to appreciate from the lowest common denominator that that's important. And it's going to be a long time. I mean, I will have long retired from this as my career before it gets to that point. But I truly believe we're headed that way. Mm-hmm. When accreditation for paramedic programs was presented 10, 12, 16 years ago, there were very few programs that were even interested in applying. And it is still a voluntary process. Not all the states have bought into this process, and it's still voluntary for the programs to participate. More states are identifying the value of accreditation, national certification. Certainly those of programs that have been in operation for a significant period of time have appreciated the limitations to a national standard curriculum. And moving towards this newer educational model certainly identifies the flexibility, the creativity, and the things that will really help EMS grow to the profession it can be.
And then that was another thing. What does, you know, sort of the accreditation community, what sort of effort did they put on contacting students and potential people that are entering paramedic programs to say, you know, here's what you can get from an accredited program versus going to mom and pop down the street.
Sure.
You know, or whatever else program. Not necessarily that those programs are, the non-accredited programs may not be bad, they may actually be good programs, but there's no guarantee that what you're getting is quality. How much of that is communicated in like a...
Well, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. The value that we can present to those interested in becoming a paramedic and going to an accredited program versus a non-accredited program forces us to explain what is the value of accreditation. And the value of accreditation is that program has voluntarily submitted itself to an outside standard that assures it meets the standards and guidelines for providing the resources necessary to help a student successfully complete a program at an entry-level practitioner focus. Not that a not accredited program can do it, but this assures that those programs meet those guidelines and standards, which are not necessarily their own, which are standards outside of their scope, their school, their state, that says you've met this benchmark and that you continually are evaluated against this benchmark once you attain it. To maintain it, you have to be able to continually demonstrate that. We're fortunate to see the statistics from the National Registry identifying that those who have completed the National Registry test who have come from accredited programs do better than those who have not come from accredited programs. So I think it's up to the accrediting body and with the help of the registry to identify that value from that perspective. Mm-hmm. But I think the programs themselves would tell you, having gone through the process, that they're better programs for doing that, because it causes them to be reflective. It causes them to be self-reflective and in such a mindset to review the things that they do to improve from one class to the next.
I want to bring you back to the lifelong learning aspect of you know, sort of the professionalism of EMS, and I had a couple of things that I was curious about. The first one I wanted to be is the constant change aspect of EMS is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And at least from where I came from, I was sort of one of the first classes that came with the new AHA standards. And the, you know, there was a, you know, I was bringing things out into the field as a student that my mentors didn't know, or, you know, because they had like, oh, they had their refresher course, but like I was getting that AHA, ACLS stuff.
Sure.
So I knew that. And there's also sort of this attitude that EMSers are kind of resistant to change, even though it's a constant in their life. And so I was just wondering thoughts on that. Like, are they actually really grumpy about change, or is it just sort of like a grumbly sort of attitude that happens in the community?
Well, I think it runs the gamut. You know, I think EMS people are more likely to welcome change in a lot of respects than a lot of other folks in different professions, only because they're exposed to it all the time. Whether it's change in their schedules, whether it's change from having to move from one station to another, but you start messing with their education and having to learn different sets of protocols and how frequently those changes happen, then you begin to experience the frustration levels.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the Heart Association, and I don't know how long you've been a paramedic, but I've probably seen since 1976, probably 20 different sets of changes in standards and guidelines mm-hmm. for from the American Heart Association and first aid, whether it be from simple CPR to where we are today in CPR. In our particular organization, we adopted the 2005-2006 changes. Within a year, modified those again to grow to a different standard and guideline that is kind of a testing model at this point. So mm-hmm. the medics in our particular system not only remembered the 15-2, moved to the 30-2, we then went to 50-2, and now we're doing 6 minutes of compressions with no ventilations and passive breathing with a non-rebreather mask with a focus on pump fast, pump hard. And I can tell you, in the period of time that I've been involved in EMS, these changes, as simple as they may sound, have increased the survivability of cardiac arrest patients and have identified the greatest change in EMS patient care more than anything I have seen with all the medicines and drugs and mm-hmm. new gadgets. As you know, we're driven by technology more than anything else, and it's the most basic thing we do. We saw the advent of automatic external defibrillation 10, 12, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. That was significant. We carried it out into the lay public. That's significant. We've seen more significant changes in basic life support that is making the difference in patient care than I could ever have imagined at this time. So, but people are reluctant to those changes? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because I think most people in EMS with any tenure have come to be skeptical about changes because, as I mentioned before, things are cyclical. What we don't mm-hmm. think works, we identify works differently 10 years later. Britillium was a good example, and now we just can't get britillium because it's in a country that won't allow it to be mined or farmed.
Right.
We don't have access to it, but probably would still be used. Bicarb, when I first started learning algorithms, it was 2 amps of bicarb, epinephrine, isoprel, calcium, and we don't use half those drugs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So change is a constant that we have to be willing to embrace and that we have to be willing to test, and with a little bit of faith, trust that it's going to work.
Where do you see reaction to change and degree of burnout or rest out? How do you see those? Are they related at all in your mind?
Oh, I think they're absolutely related. If you're in a system that doesn't run as many calls and you're changing things a lot, then it becomes difficult to apply those changes. If you're in a system that's extremely busy and you're changing things a lot, then on the other side of the coin, it becomes hard to necessarily remember those changes and see the effectiveness of them. So we as the education community have to be careful about how we present change, how we nurture change, how we evaluate it, and evaluate our personnel's ability to manage change and do it in such a way that you're always going to be mentoring them. You're always going to be supporting what they do. Identifying that always there is the propensity to make mistakes, and how you handle those mistakes for the purposes of learning and improving will make a big difference on the employee's ability to trust you, have faith in what's going on, and be more willing to make the changes that are going to be necessary down the road.
You've been in the profession for a while now, mm-hmm. 28 years. What did you do during your career to try to avoid burnout? And I know that, especially here, that there's a lot of people.
Oh boy, you're asking a guy who's been a geek in EMS ever since I've had a little red wagon as a 5-year-old running around in the neighborhood, always either being the firefighter, the police officer, or the ambulance guy. And
well, maybe the answer will be a little skewed. But
when emergency came on television, or even like Squad 58 or some of the other early programs, I was glued to the television set. When I saw emergency, I knew that's exactly what I wanted to do when I grew up. And as I got into EMS, it was a constant question. What are you going to do when you grow up? Well, I'm doing what I'm doing as I'm grown up. I'm living the dream that I had as a kid. You know, the lights and siren mentality was certainly something that kept me going because it was exciting. Mm-hmm. It was the thing that was the drive that kept you interested in what happens. I had the opportunity as an EMT to go out and teach CPR. I can't imagine the number of CPR classes I taught for nothing growing up and serving the community in our system until, you know, all the laws and all those other things said, well, you can't volunteer anytime. You got to get paid for everything you do. I would still teach CPR this day just out of the pure enjoyment of doing it for the public. And do. I mean, I'm on a circuit to go talk on behalf of the Heart Association and do periodically out of my time and no one else's time, just because it's that important to me. So I think for a lot of people in EMS, it's more than something that they are doing because they can't do anything else. There is a passion for it. And again, you have to realize what your passion is and do whatever you can to keep passionate about it. Mm-hmm. You have that obligation in yourself to challenge yourself every single day. And by the time when you think, oh, crap, I don't want to go to work, I'm sick of doing this, or, you know, I'm sick and tired of this company or whatever, then it's time to change. Mm-hmm. It's time to move on, because without the passion to do the job, it's not just yourself that you're going to burn out with. It's whoever works with you. Your attitude, the effective environment of what you bring to your agency and your service is reflective of those you work with. And I can tell you as a chief officer, it is probably the most difficult thing to deal with in our organization is how to change culture, how to change behavior, how to inspire people. And it's very, very difficult. Very difficult from an organization that has tenured people 30 years, who some are still extremely passionate about what they do, and others are counting the time for when they're going to retire. And it's that smaller group of people that are there just counting the time until they retire that bring the rest of the organization down. The worst thing that anybody could say about me in the job that I have is, this guy's retired on the job. If that's the case, I need to leave now, because if I'm not excited about what I want to do from day to day, and sure, we're going to have down times,
right?
But if I can't maintain that passion, then I've lost the opportunity to serve the patient, whether I'm in an education role or not, serving my educators and my employees. We lose that opportunity to be the best we can be.
Open Airways podcasts are produced by FISDAP with support from EMSresponder.com. All recordings express the opinions and experience of the speaker and do not constitute legal or medical advice. This and other recordings can be found at www.openairways.net.